Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, August 4th. Maui memories, they are under our skin as this week we approach the two-year mark of the wildfires. All this week we consider what we've lost and what we hold on to that is dear to our hearts after those tragic wildfires. And we take a closer look at a vital agency in our community facing headwinds. The Domestic Violence Action Center begins the search for a new leader. We hear more about efforts to reimburse families with funeral expenses relating to the deaths associated with the pandemic. And are Koki frogs keeping you up at night? We dive into why their numbers are growing in Hawaii. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, this week we turn our attention to a particular tree in Lahaina. The beloved banyan tree has become a symbol of hope and recovery. We recently talked with Theo Morrison with the Lahaina Restoration Foundation. The group is tasked with rebuilding historic Lahaina and the buildings around the Banyan Court Park. The park isn't open to the public just yet. It may in a few months. There are still some infrastructure issues to address, but you may have gotten a glimpse of the tree and the benches underneath it. Here's Morrison with more on that project and the master plan to bring back our historic buildings.
There were just benches under the banyan tree, and then we started, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago, creating new benches because we needed more benches. Let's put it that way. A lot of people sitting under the banyan tree is like 10 degrees cooler than sitting anywhere else in Lahaina. So benches are very popular. So we created more benches, but we didn't have the money for them, so we sponsored the benches. So people are able to buy a bench for $5,000 with a plaque on it with their name and a couple other little lines that can say other things. And then the key we found out the hard way was we made them out of ipe wood, which is a very, very dense wood, and it actually survived the fire. So all the benches that were made out of ipe wood that were in the park survived, and the other benches, the really older, really nice benches, but they were made out of teak. They did not survive.
Interesting. How many benches did we have when the wildfire swept through that area?
Can't remember exactly, but maybe about 15.
Okay.
Not all. Yeah, some teak and some.
But so about a dozen. Okay. So, and tell us, since the fire, then what has happened? So some of those benches survived and you're getting new benches made.
Well, we finished now. There's a total of 29 benches under the banyan tree now. And we're done with the project because we don't want it to look like a bus stop, the park. So we have enough benches under the banyan tree. Yeah, we're done and we'll just keep adding like a finish to them, especially mm-hmm. the ones, some of them now are in the sun because the tree had to be cut back. So that's the problem.
Gotcha.
But the ones underneath the tree are doing fine.
And are those the benches, the bench project, does it have a name?
No, that's a good one. The bench project.
Okay. All right. Okay. But essentially then what, were you able to get additional donations to remake some of those benches?
Yeah, $5,000 per bench. So for that $5,000, you get your name on the plaque.
But essentially, what's happened is that the community has stepped up. You've been able to replace those benches that did burn and add so many more.
Correct, yes.
Wow.
After the fire, the banyan tree was a really big deal. A lot of people have really good memories under the banyan tree. That's what it comes down to. So they wanted to be able to have a piece of that.
Wow.
Sponsoring a bench.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, right? People love Lahaina and want to see it come back. Well, you know, as we come upon this second year of the wildfires, I know you folks are working furiously to complete a master plan for the historic buildings that were destroyed or damaged.
Correct. We are responsible for eight historic buildings in Lahaina, five of which we own, three of which belong to the county. but they're all our responsibility. So this master plan is a plan for how to restore them so they will look the same from the outside. A few of them have some changes. The non-public buildings have some changes to the inside, but the public buildings will all be the same inside. Like the Baldwin home will always be the same inside. We lost all the artifacts, so we'll have to get additional artifacts donated. And then the Old Lahaina Courthouse will be the same layout, the Old Lahaina Prison and Halealoha, those will all be the same layout that they were before.
You know, I was going through my photo album and I came across pictures when I first went to Lahaina, and the pictures of those historic structures are, I'm so glad I have them. I have those memories and those pictures. But I'm sure it's bringing Lahaina back again is going to be a long haul. But as we work toward completing this master plan and figuring out how do we move forward, right? What can you do with the other buildings to help tell the Lahaina story?
Yes, we have 8 historic buildings, but there's a lot more in Lahaina. We have to focus on what we can do and what we are responsible for. So that's why we are focusing just on those 8 buildings, some of which are big, like the Old Lahaina Courthouse. That is a big building. It's a 2-story, coral block building. That's a really big building. And then the Siemens Hospital is also 2-story. The Walden Home is 2-story. Those are big buildings. So that's what we want to, that's what we are doing, as well as the parks and open spaces in Lahaina, focusing on those.
And talk about how you plan to incorporate the film about Lahaina's history and that district and how you plan to tell that story.
Way before the fire, about 3 years before the fire, we began work on a short animated film to tell the story of Moku'ula, because we all know that Moku'ula, the site, you can't really see anything. It's just like an empty lot. So we felt it was really important to tell the story. So we created this film with a tremendous amount of local input. We went around to a lot of the Hawaiians in the area, people who worked with the Friends of Moku'ula and all that, people that had a really good knowledge. And then we worked with our director, the same person who created the whale film at the Maui Ocean Center, if anybody's seen that. So we had a really good crew. It took a long time. And then the plan was to show that film in the Old Lahaina Courthouse on a regular basis. It's only 10 minutes. And that would also include an interpretive part of it, where we would have a docent explaining the whole story and the importance of Moku'ula. But we lost the courthouse, so we have been showing it free once a month on the second Friday of every month, except for August, because the second Friday of August is August 8th. We don't want to show it on August 8th. So it would be the next Friday, which would be the 15th. And we've had 100 people every time, which is really great. That means we're getting that story of that really important place out there to the public. And then when we restore the buildings, one of the buildings we'll be restoring is called the Kindergarten Building. It was the former place for Village Gallery, which was located behind the Baldwin Home in the parking lot. And we are going to turn that into a small theater and show the film there on a regular basis. And we might have other films that we show there also. Because what we are is we're the storytellers of Lahaina. That's how we get the history out there. We don't just save the history. We also tell the story. So that's a major part of what we do.
I know that so many of your workers lost their jobs because these buildings, that center is no longer, and still a lot of it is off limits. But you have been out there, working with your team on what you can, right, in some of the park areas in Lahaina?
Correct. Yeah, we're out there every day.
Talk about that and what that means when you actually are working on something and you can see the progress.
Yeah, well, right after the fire, nobody was allowed to go into Lahaina. and it was just totally restricted, shut down. Nobody could go in. And then it was months before we were able to actually go in. And one of the first times I went in, I noticed, God, the parks are just so overgrown and full of weeds and all this stuff. I thought, we can do this. We can't fix our building right now, but we can clean up these parks. Army Corps had already come through and picked up all the bigger stuff that had flown into the parks, the big stuff, and cut down the trees. But the rest was something that we took on. So it's been a tremendous amount of work. We've been doing it for at least, I don't know, 8-9 months now. We're just about finished with all the repair of the irrigation, all of which melted, and the removal of all that stuff that flew into the parks. And yeah, it makes a world of difference. All of a sudden, I told my guys, I said, people need to understand we care. When they come through, like at that point in time, a lot of the big FEMA guys and all this stuff, they were driving through to look at the disaster or whatever. And I go, let's show them that we care. And so that was the impetus to get that whole thing cleaned up. And then we started on the, then people started buying benches. So we restored all the benches, well, the ones that didn't burn in the park, and added more benches. On the day of the fire, Jesse Niesman, who's used to take care of the buildings when we had buildings and now is taking care of the parks, he actually took down the flag that was hanging at the harbor in front of the courthouse, which is a historical place for the flag to fly. He took it down because it was so windy that day. He took it down and actually ended up saving it.
And that flag is flying overhead today. We were hearing from Theo Morrison with the Lahaina Restoration Foundation about the work that it's doing to keep the stories of Maui alive. Morrison expects the master plan to rebuild the 8 historic buildings to be released later this year. And again, we understand that the park may open later this fall. As we mark 2 years since the August 8 wildfires, we plan to air reflections sent in by our listeners. We spoke with Victoria Moore in December 2024 about her book, Big Hearts on a Little Island. She sent us this recording.
As we approach the second anniversary of the Maui wildfires, the memories of all that was tragically lost are really weighing on my heart. But for me, the anniversary of the fires also has memories of light and goodness, because August 8, 2023 was the day that sparked the most inspiring grassroots movement of community care I've ever witnessed. I remember being at the shelters and community hubs in the days after the fires, just feeling completely in awe of the overwhelming love and support being offered to displaced community members. And it didn't stop. For days and weeks and months, the help never ceased. It was humanity at its best. It was locally driven and it was from the heart. As a published author, I realized that maybe the best way that I could give back to my community was to write down these beautiful stories so we could share them for generations to come. I did nearly 200 interviews with community helpers in the months after the fires to create the book Big Hearts on a Little Island. And I remember in many of the interviews, when I'd ask people what inspired them to act, why did they step up right away to help, they often look back at me almost with puzzled expressions and say matter-of-factly, it's what we do. There was no complicated thought process. It was just heart-centered action. And it's just who you are. It's just in the culture. It's just what you do. And it became very clear to me in the aftermath of the fires that Maui is an island community that takes care of each other. I wrote Big Hearts on a Little Island to preserve some of the hope and inspiration that emerged from the ashes. I want to make sure we never forget that in our darkest moment, goodness and beauty prevailed in the form of neighbors helping neighbors in big-hearted ways.
Victoria also shares with us that Big Hearts on a Little Island has sold nearly 2,000 copies since its release in November. The entire team has worked pro bono on the project so that 100% of the proceeds can be donated to the rebuilding and regrowth of the Lahaina Public Library. And the book of stories and photos was recently selected as the adult title to represent the state of Hawaii at the Library of Congress National Book Festival next month. Mahalo for sharing your thoughts, Victoria. And how are you feeling as our communities approach 2 years since the wildfires? What hopes or fears do you have about the future? And what changes have you seen in yourself and your community? Leave us a voicemail on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We just heard from the Lahaina Restoration Foundation with an update about Banyan Court Park, and we thought we'd let you know more about the park's historic centerpiece for today's quiz. Planted in 1873, the Lahaina banyan tree has stood vigil in the town center, living through Lahaina's economic history of whaling, sugar, and pineapple plantation days, and tourism. The 8-foot-tall sapling was gifted to the town to commemorate the arrival of the first American Protestant mission. It grew into a towering 60-foot tree with 16 major trunks covering almost 2 acres in the Lahaina Banyan Court Park. The tree held a record as Hawaii's oldest and largest banyan and the largest of its kind in the United States. As we know, the banyan sustained serious damage in the 2023 Lahaina blaze. And there is another large tree that was almost lost to wildfires located in Sequoia National Park. For today's quiz, we want to know what's the name of this tree. Hint, it shares a name with a Civil War general. If you think you know this bark, call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag and a deck of the card game Kumula'au from our friends at Trees for Honolulu's Future. What happened here? I stopped the wind from blowing and aimed at the ocean watching. Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com. What do you do in time and space? Lost you something you can't replace. What do you do when you pray? You know, this month has been tumultuous for the Domestic Violence Action Center. It just learned that a portion of its federal funding has been cut. It's the latest in a series of challenges. In July, Lori Tochiki was named interim CEO. This was after the center's previous CEO, Monique Ibarra, resigned following a mass exodus of staff attorneys. Ibarra was the first person to fill the leadership role after Nancy Creedman, the organization's co-founder. Creedman stepped down after 33 years at the helm. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson spoke with David Tomilowitz, the president of the board, on Friday. Tomilowitz has a media background and took an unexpected path to leadership at the center. He shared his thoughts on this moment of transition.
The Domestic Violence Action Center was founded nearly 35 years ago at this point, actually in 1991, and is the only agency of its kind in Hawaii that is exclusively focused on the needs of domestic violence survivors. We are unique in providing wraparound services for survivors ranging from our helpline and emergency response safety planning to legal representation and advocacy, housing programs, and community outreach and prevention.
And how did you get involved with the organization?
Yeah, I've been involved with the organization now for over 15 years. And like many, the founder of the organization, Nancy Creedman, was introduced to me and she pulled me in. At the time, I was the publisher for Hawaii Business Magazine. And remember, Nancy approached me and she said, David, I bet you don't know it, but domestic violence is really a business issue that you guys should be writing about. And I have to admit, at the time, it really wasn't on my list of priorities for business issues. But for folks who know Nancy, she is persistent and, you know, we continued our conversations. And she really helped me to understand that in addition to being, you know, certainly a moral and a legal and a community issue, domestic violence is an economic issue. And it costs Hawaii businesses millions of dollars every year in healthcare costs, in indirect costs, absenteeism from work. So that was the beginning of my engagement around the problem of domestic violence.
Yeah, Nancy does seem to be a force. She was very much the driving force for the organization for so long. And I think that generally speaking, sometimes there's a challenge for organizations to move past that phase, right? Where you have a really involved founder who needs to exit the organization and there needs to be some kind of new beginning.
Well, I'm not sure if it's actually a new beginning. I mean, we certainly want to continue the truly life-saving work that the Domestic Violence Action Center provides. But it is, you know, clearly a challenge in making that transition from a founder-led organization. 33 years, Nancy led the Domestic Violence Action Center. She and another woman started DVAC from, you know, she describes it as a broom closet. They were taking their lunch breaks and operating a hotline for domestic violence survivors, and then grew it to what it is today, you know, an organization that has 44 employees and provides all of these different services. So I do want to acknowledge, I mean, Nancy, our incredible founder, she is truly a giant. She is my hero, and I think she really calls upon us to be better. And those are big shoes to fill. So I would say, you know, I think it is incredibly challenging to follow in the footsteps of such a strong, charismatic founder, and especially Nancy. I'm really excited that Lori Tochiki has been named as the interim CEO for the Domestic Violence Action Center. She's the right person at this point in time to lead DVAC. Lori, for those who know her, has decades of experience advocating for Hawaii's children and families, and that's most important. She has incredible heart for this work and understands the importance of the work. Also important, she's a licensed attorney. She is a member of the Hawaii State Bar Association, and she practiced family law for 12 years. And among the services that DVAC provides, certainly those legal services are really crucial. Lori also taught at the Richardson School of Law for 23 years. She was the associate dean for student services. She developed so many attorneys here in Hawaii. And she's also certified as a senior professional in human resources. So she's the right person to take the organization forward, you know, over the next year of service that she'll provide as the interim CEO.
So she's in the role now, but we had, after Nancy, a first CEO who had stepped down from the position. And previous to that, several staff members had left the organization. So it seemed like there was a little bit of discord between leadership and some of the staffers that were there dedicated to what the organization does. What is the nature of those challenges in terms of the staff and the leadership?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, DW. I would say that, again, it just, you can imagine the challenge of following in the footsteps of a 33-year founder of an organization. And this was our first leadership transition ever at DVAC. So we really are appreciative of Monique Ibarra, who was that CEO. Monique accomplished important things while she was at DVAC. She brought a focus on employee well-being and, for instance, equipping employees with laptops and so forth to allow them, you know, more flexibility in how they did the work, et cetera. And Monique did resign, I guess, about a month and a half ago now for personal reasons.
So what is your sense of the morale among the staff these days at this time of transition?
I think everyone experiences transition in their own way. So I'm not sure there's a blanket statement for staff. I was at the agency last week and I was talking to one of the staff members and she said she is incredibly happy. She's so fulfilled, you know, with the work that she's doing. And I think that's really important to understand. The people who work at DVAC are there because they are mission driven and want to support the mission of the Domestic Violence Action Center and provide these life-saving services to survivors. That said, I mean, staff well-being is you know, along with, you know, our client well-being is the number one concern of the board of directors that I'm president of. And we've spent time in the agency meeting with leaders, meeting with staff, listening to their concerns and ideas. And we're, you know, we're all committed to moving forward together.
So how is the search for the new CEO going? How is the board approaching that?
Well, right now, Lori's going to be leading the agency for the next 12 months or thereabouts, and she will be focused on staff well-being, certainly, as we just talked about, helping to put in place staff development programs and career pathways for staff. We want to provide our staff with opportunities for professional development. She's also going to be addressing the issue of providing more legal services. And that's why we think she's the perfect leader at this point in time, because, she's an attorney. Her background at Richardson School of Law, just her deep involvement in relationships in the legal community here in Hawaii. And then within the next year, certainly, we'll start the search for a permanent CEO for DVAC. And what I would say there is that, like the first transition, we will engage staff and we will engage the community in the selection of the next CEO for DVAC.
Yeah, that's a pretty good breadth of time, but obviously this isn't something that you want to rush, right? This is something you have to be extremely thoughtful about.
There are opportunities for staff development in DVAC. The board has made the determination, you know, we want to make that investment internally and, you know, under Lori's leadership. And then at that point, go forward with finding a permanent replacement.
You talk about Lori trying to find ways to provide more legal services. Are there other changes that the organization is looking to make right now at this inflection point?
You know, I would challenge the idea of an inflection point. Actually, interestingly, Lori, Nancy, and I, along with Rex Fujichaku, who's one of our board members, had lunch yesterday. And we all agree that the path forward is to stay the course. We are committed to continuing our advocacy for survivors, continuing the truly life-saving work that DVAC provides every single day. We are seeing an increase in need for services as we had also, you know, during the pandemic, which we believe is a result of increased economic pressures in our community. Families are under economic stress, and we're seeing it in the number and the kinds of calls that we're seeing. Also, as we look forward, like all social service providers, we're concerned about the federal funding cuts that are threatened and that are happening, and that we anticipate will put even greater stress on our communities and impacts on service providers like DVAC.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned federal funding. Tell us a little bit about the funding picture that DVAC operates with in terms of slices of the pie and where it comes from in broad strokes.
Yeah, broad strokes, we certainly are, you know, receive a significant amount of federal funding, as well as some federal funding that passes through the state as well. At this point, we actually just received notification of the termination of one of our contracts that was ended early. But other than that, we have not been directly impacted as of yet by federal funding cuts. But we know that domestic violence programs across the nation have been experiencing those types of cuts. So that is something that we're, you know, watching very, very carefully.
That notice you received recently, was that expected? And are there any details you can share with us in terms of that particular funding?
I think we literally received the notice on Wednesday, so we're still, you know, exploring exactly what it means for us. But it is it's certainly an important program, but it's one of our smaller programs at this point.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like listeners to know in general terms about what the road ahead looks like for DVAC?
I think the most important thing that I want listeners to understand is that DVAC is fully operational. We are a phone call away to help. And I'd love to share our helpline number, which
Absolutely.
Is 808-531-3771. If you need help or if you're concerned about a family member or a friend, please call us. Our staff are exceptional. These are 44 just incredibly mission-driven professionals with deep knowledge about the problem of domestic violence, and they can help. Don't hesitate. Please call.
That was David Tomilowitz, president of the board of directors for the Domestic Violence Action Center. He spoke with HPR's D.W. Gibson about the challenges the organization faces as it begins its search for a new leader.
Next month is Classical Music Month. and HPR is counting down your top 100 compositions. Make sure your favorites are in the running. Tell us your top composers and classical music pieces. Voting ends August 31st. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/classicalmonth.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
You know, during the pandemic, the federal government began providing financial assistance for families who lost loved ones to COVID. And while many in the Micronesian community were disproportionately affected, they learned they were not eligible for funeral assistance. Here with an update on the situation is HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so, you know, we know that the federal funds weren't available, but our state here, our community, did step up.
Yeah, and actually it was the city and county of Honolulu that appropriated $2 million for this Ohana Funeral Service program, and only Micronesians living on Oahu or have lived in Oahu who lost a loved one qualify for such program. And so $2 million was appropriated to the program. $1.5 million goes directly to the families that were impacted, while $500,000 were allocated to the local nonprofit We Are Oceania, which is dedicated to Micronesian advocacy. And Executive Director Josie Howard was actually helping with that program.
I feel very deeply appreciated to those that make this possible. So much gratitude for this financial support to be available to the families. And I just feel very lucky that we're, for those people who live here in Oahu, we have questions for people who live in Maui and Hilo. They like, you know, ask us, what about us? One of my thoughts is, you know, it took one person to think about it. And I tell people, like, maybe you can, you know, advocate to your leaders there to also rise up for you and ask this kind. Part of me feels sad that not everybody who got impacted by COVID, who lives in the state of Hawaii, is able to get it. I'm very grateful that at least some, and also not only that, but if this opens a window of awareness that these are the kind of things that you can advocate for to be able to get people that are not receiving the same kind of services that are other, like that is available to everybody else. This has become a norm for us over nation citizens. It feels good to be included. It feels so good to be a part of it. Because we pay tax, you know, we work, we pay tax. And I just feel like at least this small portion of people who live on Oahu have an opportunity to feel how it is to be part of the whole culture or like the whole community.
And so far, she said that only 5 people on Oahu have applied for the program. And kind of stepping back with the data point, when I reached out to the State Department of Health, they led me to their website that still has that COVID breakdown by ethnicities, cases, state by state. And there are 250 Micronesians who passed away to COVID. So they made up 12% of the total state deaths due to COVID. Josie Howard is still kind of doing these, conducting outreaches to the community, but because death is such a sensitive topic, you know, it's a slow process to get people to even apply for that. And so, so far they're doing like another outreach on August 16th at the Kapi'olani Regional Park from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. But it really did take the community to really reach out to their city council members to really push for this program, because at the federal level, they've had this program available since May of 2023, but excluded people from the Compacts of Free Association or COFA citizens. And stepping back, the Compacts of Free Association, Micronesians from Palau, the Marshall Islands, and the Federated States of Micronesia, they have shared treaties with the U.S. called the Compacts of Free Association. And so that means that Micronesians can migrate visa-free into the country to access jobs, healthcare, and education. In exchange, the U.S. military can access the island's waters, their airspace, and land. But they don't qualify for such federal program. And when I reached out to FEMA, they did decline an interview but sent a very vague general statement that said FEMA is focused on providing aid and assistance for American citizens following emergencies and natural disasters. FEMA will follow all applicable law in regards to non-citizens requesting assistance.
And who else did you talk to?
I did talk to Councilmember Esther Kia Aina, and she talks about the challenges that many COFA citizens in the U.S. face.
As you know, the federal government, it's been challenging to have FAS citizens become eligible for a lot of the social benefits, because in 1996, under the Welfare Reform Act, FAS citizens who were eligible prior to that law were made ineligible since 1996. And the Hawaii delegation, in concert with other members in the continent who had large populations of the Micronesian communities living in their districts, tried to make them re-eligible. And of course, that did come through fruition in the last couple of years, both for the Medicaid program, as well as for a SNAP, or the food stamp program, temporary assistance for needy families, TANF, and supplemental security income, which is SSI.
So non-Native Hawaiian Pacific Islanders were actually the most hard-hit communities during the COVID-19 pandemic, even though they make up 4% of the state population. So Josie Howard said that she's still conducting more outreach, with the next outreach day to be August 16th at Kapi'olani Regional Park from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Okay, and hopefully the people that are eligible will apply. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with HBR's Cassie Ordonio. You can read her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
You're probably watching the new Chief of War series on Apple TV+, and if you're looking for additional context or just want to keep the buzz going, check out HPR's new podcast, Feathers and Fire. I'm Russell Subiono. Join me and Mehana Maka'ina'i for fun and lively discussion about the series Saturdays on all major podcast platforms and at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
Now it's time for the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the history of Lahaina's historic banyan tree. It once held a record of Hawaii's oldest and largest banyan. The tree was damaged in the August 8th wildfire. And last year, about a third of the tree was removed in order to encourage the tree to redirect its healing efforts. Small sections of the tree have also been grafted to the damaged areas. And we asked you about another tree that, like the Lahaina banyan, was nearly destroyed in a wildfire. This magnificent tree faced a lightning-caused wildfire in September 2021. Firefighters wrapped 10 feet of this giant sequoia in protective aluminum material to minimize the risk that the fire would ignite exposed areas. As for the tree's name, the story goes that a naturalist who once served as a lieutenant during the Civil War named this giant sequoia after his general. We asked you for the name of this tree. We were looking for General Sherman, named for William Tecumseh Sherman. And congrats to our winner, Mele Stokesbury from Maui, got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Koki frogs have been a nighttime nuisance on Hawaii Island since the 1980s. They were accidentally introduced from Puerto Rico, and their populations have exploded on the Big Island. One study found that in the past 14 years, the frogs have gone from occupying 30% of roadside areas to half of them. And the frogs may be moving into higher elevation habitats as well. But what makes them so good at being an invasive species? A new paper titled Fortune May Favor the Flexible explores what makes koki frogs such successful invaders in Hawaii. Eva Fisher is an assistant professor at the University of California, Davis. She spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about how an invasive species like the koki managed to thrive outside their native habitat.
So some features of invasive organisms or animals rather are generally shared. So things like having a generalist diet, being able to deal with novel predators. And so some of those things were known for koki to be generally true. Specifically true for koki is this very cool feature that they skip the tadpole stage. So frogs are very rare on islands because they don't like salt water, so it's tricky for them to get there. And once they get there, they often don't have standing water for reproduction. But if you skip the tadpole stage, then you're free from that need to have a pond or stream or lake or something. What people had looked less at was specifically some of their other kinds of behaviors. And so there are some ideas that being also very bold and exploratory can help you if you are going to invade somewhere and be connected to some of these other traits. Like if you're bold and exploratory, maybe you're also more likely to try a new and different food or to move into a new and different habitat. So as another kind of example of koki, one of the breeding sites that they use in Hawaii are actually the holes formed in lava. So these little lava tubes, which are not present in their native environment, but are really awesome breeding sources for them in Hawaii. So thinking specifically about behavior and specifically about this kind of bold exploratory scenario. And then the other thing that we were thinking about a lot was the other big difference to their native range is that they're at very high densities. And so we sort of had these two different ideas, which were that, well, if the populations really explode, maybe the guys who move out away and sort of are motivated to leave are the ones who are most bold and exploratory. Or maybe they at the center start to become really competitive and interact with each other in that way. And so the guys who are moving out are actually the more shy ones because they're just trying to get away from other frogs. And so in the field, when we tested them, we put them in a little box and we basically said, how long does it take you to come out of the box? This is a pretty common measure of boldness that people use in all sorts of studies. And then we also did what's called an open field where you let an animal wander around an open, sort of unprotected, unsafe, scary feeling space and say, how much do you move? How much of the arena are you walking around in versus kind of sitting in a corner? We really found support mostly for the idea that it's those exploratory guys who are expanding the range. So they move more, they explore more, and so they're the ones pushing outward rather than somehow being better able to compete. And so it was also cool to see that the other important piece was that we thought, well, maybe only density or only elevation will matter and not the combination, but it is really also the combination that seems to be important for how they differ in the field.
But not only that, I mean, those were pretty subtle changes that you recognized between these different groups. And that's a finding, too. And you had kind of an interesting theory as to why that would happen in the lab.
Yeah. So the differences weren't huge at first, maybe a little disappointing. We like to have big differences. But we then thought, well, it would be really interesting to see how fixed these differences might be between the different populations. So have they genetically diverged to be better at living at high elevation? Or is this actually just an environmental thing where they're acting different in these different spaces? And so then we brought all the same frogs, and this was really important. They're the same individuals. We tested them kind of right after we plucked them out of the wild in Hawaii, and then we tested them again a few weeks later in the lab. And in the lab, everybody looked the same. High elevation, high density, low density. And so that then suggested to us that the differences we were seeing, those subtle differences, might also be subtle because it's actually behavioral flexibility and not a fixed genetic difference that really matters for these behaviors. And so first, we were again a little bit maybe disappointed or surprised. There's very, very cool work in other kinds of creatures about adaptation to high elevation and low elevation. But then we thought about it a bit more and realized this is actually really cool because that suggests that coqui are just super flexible and able to adapt sort of immediately to what's going on in their environment. And that could also be a really key piece of being a good invader.
And there are a couple ways that you can think about the implications. One is for coqui frogs specifically and conservation and methods of eradication. So start with, how findings like these could inform future efforts.
I mean, I think the tough news maybe is that they are definitely good invaders. They are super flexible. They are very good at sort of rolling with the punches. And so they will likely continue to be good invaders in Hawaii. But I think that, you know, there are maybe some potential to leverage that exploratory interest to, you know, think about it, are there better ways to potentially trap them or to control them in that way. We also, which wasn't part of the study, tried to mess around a little bit with giving them artificial breeding sites to try to get them to put eggs somewhere where we could then find them in a conservation context, potentially destroy them. And so, right, I think it's like, how can we think about using this to maybe lure them into something rather than seeing it as a disadvantage.
What sorts of questions do you still have about biology or behavior of these frogs?
Oh my gosh, I have so many questions about coqui. So they are really awesome. And I know that them being invasive in Hawaii is not great for Hawaii. But for us as a study system, it's actually really amazing because we also can collect them and bring them into the lab and not have some of the same ethical concerns that we generally have with collecting wild animals, and then contribute something back both to basic behavioral biology as well as thinking about conservation. And we also do some neurobiology in my lab. And so the other thing we're really interested in the coqui is actually their parental behavior, which is something people maybe don't know about, is that they're pretty good parents. And specifically, it's dad who actually hangs out and takes care of those eggs that are laid on land and waits around for them to hatch. And so that's something that we are interested in my lab in general. And we're very interested in with the coqui right now.
Why does parental behavior matter?
There's a couple of different answers to that. So parental behavior is evolutionarily really widespread, and we understand why you should do it once it evolves, but how and why parental care evolves in the first place is trickier to understand. And so coqui are a cool model. And the other thing about parental behavior is most of what we know about underlying mechanisms like hormones and molecules in the brain and brain regions comes from mammals. And the thing about mammals is that once mom is lactating, you cannot get rid of her. Whereas in frogs, including coqui, we actually see a lot of male uniparental care, so solo dads. And we also see that parenting has evolved repeatedly within frogs. So we also work on South American poison frogs, totally independent evolution of parenting behavior. And then coqui are separate. And within the families that they're in, there's also variation where it's sometimes mom, sometimes dad, sometimes both parents together. And so from an evolutionary standpoint, we also are really interested in this question of when we see the same kinds of things evolve in different animals, like parental behavior or aggression or mating or pick your favorite behavior. Does evolution reuse the same building blocks? So the same genes, the same molecules, or are there lots of different ways to build a parent? Mm-hmm. And that question, that sort of key overarching question, is important from just an evolutionary basic biology standpoint, but it's also actually really critical because it underlies the assumption that we can use animals to understand humans in a biomedical context as well.
Is there anything else you want to add or anything you've learned as you've done some of this field research?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing, so we did a little bit of citizen science. We sort of piloted some things with some people who were really willing to work with us and set up some PVC pipes in their yard to see if we could trap some coqui. And the other thing that was just so great was that people were really informed about these animals in their backyards and willing to work with us and chat with us and check to see whether they had trapped some cokie. And so we did that for a couple of months, and we're not actively doing it now, but we're hoping to go back to the field and to also expand on that project and think about how we might also be able to partner with schools and things. So yeah, the other thing that we love to do is go out and interact with people and talk to them about the critters that are in their backyard. And opinions vary across Hawaii. People feel different ways about the cokie, but from my perspective or the perspective of my lab, we think you're pretty lucky to have them cruising around outside.
Next time folks hear them at night or in their backyard, what do you think they should be thinking about?
I think the thing that is challenging but also interesting is that they're an invasive species, and that comes with some problems. Fortunately, they're not doing nearly as much damage as a lot of other invasive species we're aware of. But I think also to think about how our relationships with things change over time, and how would they feel if they suddenly weren't hearing them at night anymore, and how things become part of the landscape and our experience. And so I think also, I guess, as a scientist, to me, it's like, well, anything you think about is good, because just having some curiosity about the world around you is pretty excellent.
Pretty excellent indeed. That was Eva Fischer, assistant professor at UC Davis. She spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about a new paper into what makes tokoki frogs tick and why they're so invasive on the island of Hawaii. We'll have links to her research on our website after the show. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about the Visitor Bureau's plan to market Maui. The governor has set aside $6 million to do that. Do you have a Maui memory you'd like to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.